Up next from MAP, Emery Levins, co-founder of Rocky Mountain Institute, discusses implementation strategies for advanced energy efficiency.
On Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation at the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to introduce a new presentation in our MAP Energy series.
Emery Levins was a MAP Ming Visiting Professor for Energy and the Environment at Stanford. This lecture series was sponsored by MAP as part of its commitment to fostering sustainable energy education. For more information, visit MAP online at maproyalty.com. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
And now, here is our presentation from MAP.
I'm Ralph Cavanna. We are now at the fourth of the lectures that Emery is giving in his capacity as Stanford's MAP Ming Visiting Professor on Energy and the Environment. He's also sponsored, of course, by the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering here at Stanford. The theme for the lectures is Concepts and Practice in Advanced Energy Efficiency. And as you know by now, if you've been here during the course of the week, in the field of energy efficiency, this is as advanced as it ever gets. Emery has, over the first three lectures, addressed buildings, industry, and transportation. And in the course of doing that, he has presented a vivid and detailed vision of what could be more and better energy services with dramatically less energy and pollution. And I would say that about half of the questions you have sent forward have been some variation on the theme over the first three lectures of how on earth would we get there as a practical matter. Now, there are lots of people trying to answer that question, some terrifically good ones here at Stanford. And why should you hang on every word from Levins tonight as he undertakes to answer that question? And I wanted to just give you one reason if you needed another after you finished marveling at the text of the program. And that is simply this, that if you contemplate the individuals who are the world's most important decision makers on energy efficiency policy and practice, think of the individuals in government at all levels, in the private sector, at all levels. And then identify the single person who over the last 30 years has had the best collective access to all of those people, from the heads of state to the committee chairs to the auto company CEOs to the heads of the world's utilities and oil companies. And you ask, who is that person? Would you please join me in welcoming Emery Levins for his fourth lecture?
Thank you, Ralph. Thank you all for coming back for more. And I've never given a talk like this before, so let's see what happens. And I'm going to try it in the spirit of Raymond Williams' remark that to be truly radical is to make hope possible, not to spare convincing. So I'll try to make some hope possible about realizing the enormous potential I've described in the past three lectures for big, cheap energy savings. Let me start with a very concrete, down-to-earth example of why this matters. Osage, Iowa, is a town of little under 4,000 people with an 11-person municipal utility providing basic services. And in a decade of giving basic advice to homes and small businesses about how to save energy and money, they did so well that they were able to prepay the utility's debt, build up an emergency fund for the next ice storm, cut the rates five times in 5 years to only half the Iowa average, keep the existing factories competitive, attract two new ones with lower rates, and keep over $1,000 per household per year in town, circulating around Main Street, supporting local jobs and multipliers, and making Osage noticeably richer than comparable towns nearby. Now, the principle at work here is really arrestingly simple. If you can't keep your bathtub full because the water keeps running down the drain, do you need a bigger water heater or do you need a plug? plugs are simple and effective. I'm going to return to this theme a little later on, particularly tomorrow night, talking about the role of energy efficiency in alleviating global poverty. But let's see how we're doing in capturing that kind of potential in the country writ large that Osage did so simply and effectively. I was heavily criticized in 1976 for suggesting in an article in Foreign Affairs the total U.S. energy use, rather than heading towards the northeast corner as officially forecast, could actually level off and come down, providing the same growing volume of energy services with less energy, less money, more brains, better technology, bringing more work out of the energy. And after the dust settled, it turned out this was more plausible than people thought. Well, actually, the heavy black line is what actually happened so far, and the energy saved so far each year is a little over twice the energy we're getting from oil. This was saved not all through efficiency, some of it through changes in the composition of the economy, a little bit through behavioral change. Of course, the official forecast is still an extrapolation of past trends, but we now know how to do a lot better than this blue line because we have much more powerful technologies now. And yet, what we've done so far, cutting by essentially half the energy intensity of the economy, just scratches the surface. And let's dissect that a bit to see where we've done well or not so well. If you count one as the energy used to make a dollar of GDP in 1975 and then correct for inflation, you find that we're 46% down in total primary energy per dollar of GDP. We are not doing very well in the efficiency of light vehicles. That's stagnated or even gotten a little worse. And it hit a new 22-year low 5 years ago. And then model year 2005, it rose 0.4 miles a gallon to 21 miles a gallon, which is about something like four worse than a Model T. So it's all the more impressive that despite that stagnant efficiency level in cars and light trucks, which are so important in oil use, we've still cut oil per dollar GDP, which is the black line here, by half. Imagine what we would do with efficient vehicles. Natural gas, it's down 56% per dollar of GDP, and if you took out the growing use of gas for power generation, which is the only use that's growing, that would be a 63% intensity reduction in everything else. Not bad. But there's a laggard up here, this red line. That's electricity per dollar of GDP. That's only down 15%. Why could that be lagging behind the other kinds of savings? Well, most places still charge you electric prices or rates based on historic embedded average costs rather than the cost of the next unit of production, which is often higher. Your bill isn't itemized. It's just so much for your electricity last month. You don't know how much went to the refrigerator and how much to the lights. Electricity is more heavily subsidized than any other form of energy. It has the most split incentives between who pays the electric bill and who chooses the devices that will use the electricity. And in 48 states, we reward the distribution utility for selling you more electricity and penalize them for cutting your bill. Like it sounds, this is just as dumb as a possum. We need to stop doing it. But given those five reasons, it's pretty obvious why we're lagging on electric efficiency, and yet that's the costliest form of energy, so it's the most lucrative kind to save. So we have lots to do there. And I want to go through the progress in implementation that's been just as radical as the progress I've described the past 3 days in technology and in integrative design to put technologies together into systems. So I'll take this in six categories: oil, barrier busting in general, how to market efficiency, and then three electrical topics. Now, I want to start also with a remark for any economists who might be present that it would be helpful and theoretically correct to have higher energy prices because energy prices are not fully reflecting social cost. This is, of course, politically the most difficult policy instrument to attempt, but it has some other problems. It's not necessary because the dramatic efficiency gains I've described the past three nights are very profitable even at old low energy prices. It's interesting that in a recent five-year period, energy intensity fell 3% a year despite record low and falling energy prices. Something else was getting our attention. And actually, you can get behavior exactly contrary to relative price signals. 1990 to 96, folks in Seattle were paying half the price per kilowatt hour that they were in Chicago, and yet they were saving electricity 12 times faster in peak load, almost 4,000 times faster in energy terms, which is the opposite of what you'd expect from relative prices. The folks with the cheaper electricity save faster than the folks with expensive electricity. Why is that? Basically, I think because Seattle City Light helped you save and Commonwealth Edison tried to stop you from saving. In other words, there are other things even more important than price. And that helps explain why high energy prices are not sufficient for efficient energy use. If you don't do barrier busting to enable people to respond to price, not much happens. That's why DuPont found that its European chemical plants were just as inefficient as its American ones, even though they had long paid twice the energy price. It's also interesting that Dow Louisiana saved over $110 million a year with over a 200% return on investment from 12 years of shop floor efficiency actions. And right next door, Dow Texas didn't do that. They may have saved something, but they didn't track it, so we don't know what, and it appears that not much went on there. So just having roughly similar prices wasn't enough. We had to pay attention. Higher prices are also often not the most effective policy instrument, especially in buying new cars, where I think rebates, which I'll mention later, would work better than fuel taxes in getting people to buy efficient cars. And people are really quite complicated. They're influenced by a lot of things beside price. So I think getting the price right, although desirable, is a weaker instrument than improving ability to respond to price. We really need to do both. And in a little bit, I'm going to get into about 60 or 80 market failures that actually dominate behavior in using energy and buying efficiency, and they require close attention. Each of those is a business opportunity, and each needs attention. Now, lest you think that I'm being cavalier about price, let me remind you we've just been trying the high price approach experimentally. We've been testing historic highs in a lot of energy prices in this country, and most policymakers in this country are afraid of costly energy, even though, of course, that's what our strongest competitors have long had, and that's why they became a lot more efficient than we did, I think more than any other single factor. I would agree that price had that effect. So in the past few years, Congress simply refused to raise gasoline taxes, so OPEC did it for us. The White House rejected Kyoto out of a claimed fear that we might need, some of their studies said, $50 a ton carbon taxes to comply. And other White House policies, meanwhile, soon helped raise world market prices by the equivalent of $80 to $160 per ton of carbon to levels several times those that were predicted to wreck the economy. So we ended up paying the carbon tax, but we paid it to others, not ourselves, and we missed out on the policy framework that would drive a carbon reduction. Interesting experiment. Now, the markets are nonetheless now preparing for carbon trading. We don't know what the right price is, and we should discover that in the market rather than try to guess it. But we know that whatever the right number is, it's not zero, and it's better to be approximately right than precisely wrong. Whenever we do get to carbon cap and trade, it will, of course, be vital not to indulge in our normal practice of ancestor worship through grandfather clauses, where we say anybody who is already polluting can go on doing so. Any new market entrant, however, will have to pay for the privilege. This obviously discriminates in favor of incumbents and therefore suppresses competition. The wider context here, I think, in which we should consider any energy taxation or cap and trade regimes is that a number of European countries have been correctly experimenting with shifting taxation from what we want more of, like jobs and income, to what we want less of, consumption and depletion of resources, because this will correctly signal new relative scarcities and increase total factor productivity. At least we should be neutral between factor inputs. What we tend to do now is to tax employment and subsidize capital investment. So, of course, we have imbalances. Ideally, I think we would get correct prices and we would tweak the trim tabs necessary to enable people to respond to price and therefore vault the barrier. So what are these numerous market failures whose repair would actually let price work? Well, let me start with oil, where there are four very obvious market failures. One is that the stuff looks a lot cheaper than it really is, and however you assess the hidden or uncounted or external costs of getting and using oil, they're big. Our analysis, as I presented last night, assumes that these externalities are all worth zero, a conservatively low estimate. Most customers, even quite sophisticated ones, secondly, don't have very good information on alternatives, especially about efficiency. If anything that you've heard here the last three nights was not already in your brain, we just identified a market failure. And then there's all the stuff I don't know either, and are not knowing that as a market failure because theoretical free markets require perfect information about the future. Most customers also take a very short-term view of energy savings. They have a high time value of money. And those high implicit discount rates mean that, for example, the decision whether to buy an efficient car is about as important as the decision whether to buy floor mats to put in it, as people end up looking at just the first year or two of savings. Also, there are a lot of other market failures and institutional barriers that slow implementation. I'll get into those a little later. Now, there are five ways governments can help overcome these specific barriers to using oil in a way that saves money. And the most effective way we found to stimulate demand for very efficient light vehicles is called a feebate, a term from Art Rosenfeld, a concept that he and I and Dick Garwin variously invented independently in the early 70s. And it's a combination of a fee and a rebate. The idea is you go to the dealer to buy a vehicle of the size you want, and around that size, there are different models. The less efficient ones will pay a fee. The less efficient they are, the bigger the fee. That money will then be used to pay you a rebate for buying one of the more efficient ones. The more efficient it is, the bigger the rebate. So we broaden the price spread through this balanced fee-bate system to such a degree that it bridges or arbitrages the spread in discount rate between you as a private buyer and society. That is to say, you will now look at all 14 years worth of life cycle fuel savings, not just the first year or two, and you will therefore make a decision that is economically efficient for the whole society. It turns out that about 90% of the effect of such feebates comes from automakers making cars more efficient to try to shift them into the zone that will get rebates instead of paying fees. And that's natural. And it also turns out that the kinds of value they add to the vehicle to achieve greater efficiency have an inherently higher profit margin than the rest of the car. Therefore, their profits go up. Some of them are starting to figure this out. Came up with another interesting policy innovation in winning the oil endgame, free at oilendgame.com, and that is the notion that many Americans actually can't afford personal mobility and can't even afford a reliable way to get to work in areas without mass transit, which is many places. If African-American households had the same car ownership as white households, it would cut the employment disparity in half. This is a big deal. So we suggested using some creative financial engineering, some of it modeled on the Sallie Mae student loan outfit, to enable a low-income family at no or very low extra cost to get into a very efficient, reliable, warranted extended service contract new car that they can afford to run, and it would come with price-hedged gasoline and bundled insurance. And then in concert with that, we would scrap clunkers and get them off the road faster to clean up the air faster by a few years. And the combination of those two initiatives would create a new million car a year market that didn't exist before because these are not creditworthy customers. They could never before imagine buying a new car. So some folks in Detroit really like this idea. Governments buy a lot of non-tactical vehicles, both civil and military. governments at all levels. And if we aggregate that procurement and buy just the most efficient class of cars on the market, or light trucks, and buy the right type for the job it's going to do, that would do a lot to build markets. Then there's a method proven in Sweden and a little bit here called a golden carrot, in which some third party goes out to the marketplace and says, who would like to buy how many at what price range of vehicles or other things you want to promote with certain characteristics? And then you take that list and go back to, in this case, the automakers and say, we've identified markets for you, and we've done all your market research, and these are the groups that have actually written a letter of intent, here it is, saying that if you produce a car with these specs, they'll buy this many of them at this price over these years. So that takes away your risk of introducing the product. That works awfully well. We also suggested a platinum carrot, which is now emerging in the form of the Automotive XPRIZE, to get more competitive juices flowing. In the case of heavy trucks, it turned out the big missing ingredient was information. When my MBAs brought in the spreadsheet saying you get a 60% internal rate of return from tripling the efficiency of an 18-wheeler, I was rather puzzled that this hadn't happened already, because the trucking industry is smart and competitive. And I thought, gee, maybe they don't know they can do this. So I started calling up the heads of very large companies we work with and said, did you know you could do this? And they said, no, that's interesting. The truck maker said we could save maybe a tenth of the fuel and it would cost a lot. How do you do it? So I told them. And the answer we got back was sort of like, well, let's build one and test it. And if it does what you say, we'll tell them that's what we want. That's the right answer. So we started facilitating conversations between one such company and its truck suppliers, and it didn't take them long to discover the first 25% saving is free. And then the buyer said, free's not good enough. I want to invest for a return. What can you do for me? And then they got to arguing about whether they'll get 13, 16, 18, 20 miles a gallon ultimately. They now get 6.5. Well, the company's called Walmart, so every mile per gallon improvement in their heavy truck fleet drops $42 million a year to their bottom line. So based on our analysis and their confirmation, they told the industry, from January 2007, and they said this about five quarters before that, from January 2007, all the new trucks you sell us must be a quarter more efficient than now. And soon after that, twice as efficient, because we're going to double the efficiency of our fleet by 2015. Well, that's going to drop $330 million a year to their bottom line. That's a year. So they will make billions net present value on the deal. They are highly motivated. The supply chain is responding magnificently. And now we're out broadening the buyer's consortium and helping the truck makers speed up their innovation. In the case of airlines, there's still a different problem. A lot of the customers are broke. They can't afford the efficient new planes that would dig the legacy airlines out of half of their cost hole. Now, if philosophically you want to help them, which you may or may not, one good way to do that would be federal loan guarantees specifically for buying very efficient new planes, but those could be offset by equity warrants, as was done in the Chrysler bailout, so that there's no net cost to Treasury. But for every plane so financed, let's scrap one of the inefficient, worst one-fifth of the fleet planes parked in the desert, because if those inefficient planes ever get back in the air, they will waste more oil. And, of course, they will block both the purchase and the development of very efficient new planes. So the old inefficient ones are worth more dead than alive. Let's take them out back and shoot them. Boeing likes that idea. I said a little last night about the important role of military science and technology in financing, particularly the commercialization of new processes for advanced ultralight strong materials, which we need to triple or better military platform efficiency. The military has its own very compelling reasons for needing to do that, but that could then transform the civilian car, truck, and plane industries, and then we wouldn't need the oil, we wouldn't need to fight over the oil, we could have mega missions in the Gulf, mission unnecessary, and the warfighters really like that idea. There are methods already agreed in principle by the stakeholders to help the weak balance sheet automakers and their suppliers to retool and retrain, again, without net cost to Treasury. There are ways to tweak USDA rules to speed the transition from hydrocarbons to carbohydrates, and there are other fashions in which we could get out of our own way that I'll get to later. Now, there's also a big slate of opportunities besides fee baits, which ought to be piloted first at a state and regional level. And the most important would be to reward electric and gas utilities for saving natural gas, not selling more of it. In light vehicles, you can shift registration fees and excise taxes to efficient models. In fact, the District of Columbia, on our advice, has already done this. The excise tax that you pay if you live in the district and buy a new vehicle goes to zero if it's very efficient, but goes up a little, enough to balance the zero part, if it's very heavy and therefore wears out the streets faster, a quintessentially local concern that cannot be federally preempted. You can do congestion charges, which saves a lot of fuel of cars idling or just running inefficiently in slow traffic. Stockholm cut its traffic by a quarter in the first month of a congestion charge and boosted its daily public transit ridership by 40,000. Same thing is going on in a number of other cities. You can do smart vehicle procurement, aggregating all levels of government. You can do the kind of leadership the New York Taxi and Limo Commission did after some very Byzantine politics went on to promote hybrid taxis, which had previously been prohibited. And the drivers love it because they're so much more reliable as well as cheaper to run. You can do pay-at-the-pump insurance as part of a more interesting, broader reform to shift taxation to keep the roads and bridges up from fuels to roads and driving. We're going to have to do that anyway as people use less fuel more efficiently, or as they shift to homebrew fuels, perhaps like homemade hydrogen. You can even fund the initial dealer carrying charges for stocking super-efficient cars, so that's what people will find in the showroom, and you can pay bonuses to the people who sell those efficient cars. A little bonus to a car salesperson goes a long way to get them to sell that model instead of another one. In heavy trucks, there are a number of reforms and harmonizations across state rules that would enable the truckers to use bigger, heavier trucks, but fewer of them, and with improved safety by having a uniform 60-mile-an-hour speed limit and very much better brakes. So although the truck would be heavier, it would stop shorter. Although it could be a little longer, there'd be a lot fewer of them, and everybody would get safer as well as saving lots of fuel. And we should also do fuel economy driver's ed. Even the most experienced drivers often don't quite have the engine and transmission maps in their head. It's too complicated. And there are ways to improve feedback to the driver and use informatics and logistics better. There's a lot that can be done with biofuels integrated with general farming and ranching reforms by way of local procurement and state procurement, labeling, maybe detaxation, maybe bond funding, as some states are doing, total flex vehicles that can burn any fuel on the fly, community-supported agriculture models for biofuels, and so on. A lot of this will help keep more money in the local communities, Osage style. Now, just to show what these policies can do for oil, if you look at the new sales of cars, the official forecast in 2004 assumed that 5% of new cars would be hybrids and not at all good hybrids by 2025, and that by that time the average new light vehicle would be half a mile a gallon more efficient than it was in 1987. Not very good. Well, we showed that if you simply allowed the model to include incrementally improved vehicles, academy mobiles, that save a quarter of the fuel and pay back in less than a year, if those can enter the market, then they take about half the market without any policy initiatives. The inefficient vehicle stock goes down along the dotted line gradually. If, however, you introduced standard fee baits, then that capture would improve 20 or 30 percentage points. And if you also allowed tripled efficiency vehicles to come into the model, then with the same fee bait, they would rapidly get about two-thirds of the market. A bigger fee bait, equivalent to counting a $3.50 a barrel oil externality, which is how the market actually valued oil price volatility, nothing about security and climate, just a financial parameter, further speeds entry and adoption of state-of-the-art vehicles. If you do the scrap and replace for low-income families, that enhances the savings slightly, but it enhances equity a lot. And you can then use some kickstart policies. I'll just go back one. Look at what's happening to the start of the green wedge. It's moving back a little bit, but more importantly, the takeoff point is getting a lot steeper. It's taking off faster because of policies like smart government procurement and platinum carrot. And if you do retooling support for the industry, again, you get better long-term capture. You see how the green goes up there. And then if you remove model constraints so new vehicles keep improving as the old ones do, then you capture their long-term potential, and by about 2030, the old ones are about gone and the new ones have taken over. So this is what the stock of light vehicles would look like. We would squeeze out the inefficient ones, jump quickly over the incrementally improved ones, and by the 2040s, essentially everything would be tripled efficiency. Of course, there could well be other stuff coming in here, fuel cell cars, plug-in hybrids, whatever, that we haven't explicitly shown, but with the same logic. Okay, let's get to general barrier busting, not specifically about oil. What are the obstacles that prevent buying energy efficiency? Well, there's a whole prospector's guide about this on pages 11 to 20 of Climate Making Sense and Making Money, which you'll find on the RMI website. It's 10 years old, but still good. And we identified a lot of specific market failures in eight types. I'm going to go through briefly each of those categories and say what the big problems are, what you can do about them to turn each stumbling block into a stepping stone. And I think this barrier busting should really top the policy agenda. It's much more important than fiddling with the prices. Capital misallocation, big deal. Most companies don't pay much attention to energy. They say it's a 1 or 2% factor cost because many CEOs happen to forget where saved overheads go, straight to the bottom line. I had a CEO of a Fortune 50 company forget that. And I had to point out that if in his, I think it was 92 million square feet of facilities worldwide, he achieved what one of his engineers had in one factory, his total net earnings that year would go up by something like 56%. That got his attention, but he hadn't made that comparison before. Most companies buy stuff based on first cost only, not life cycle cost. And if you think about, say, the wiring up in the ceiling of your office, you can often get months payback, in other cases, a year or less, just by using fatter wire so there's less electric resistance, because the wire-sized table in the National Electrical Code is meant to prevent fires, not to save money. Most people don't realize that. But it isn't bought because it's specced, after all, by the low-bid electrician, who wouldn't be the low-bid electrician if she selected much fatter wire and paid for much more copper. And anyway, the electrician isn't going to pay the electric bill, so there's a split incentive there. High-efficiency magnetic ballast with a 60% internal rate of return only got 9% market share before they were required by federal law. Utilities still misallocate $1 billion a year to inefficient distribution transformers, where the efficient amorphous iron ones would have over a 14% after-tax return. So there's a lot of inappropriate purchasing behavior, shall we say, even in normally well-informed firms with sharp pencils. And only a fifth of the American companies that do look beyond first cost actually use discounted cash flow methods, but generally in the executive suite, not on the shop floor where the engineers are told to use simple payback. And typically, even a decade ago, the engineers were told to do better than a two-year simple payback. That was the median. But that was about six times the marginal cost of capital. Now many companies are even shorter-sighted. And this widespread practice of requiring an order of magnitude faster return on efficiency than on general investment is equivalent to an order of magnitude price distortion. Again, that's more important than fiddling a little bit with the price. This is really a big distortion. And actually, in theory, efficiency should get a discount rate a little more favorable than the marginal cost of capital because it's lower risk than general corporate investment. Now, as a result of these kinds of mistakes and many others, by 1990, I figured the United States had already misallocated $1 trillion to unnecessary air conditioning equipment and its power supplies, two-fifths of the total peak load, that we would not have bought if we designed the buildings optimally in the first place, to produce the best comfort at the least cost. And that turned out to be because of perfectly perverse incentives among all two dozen parties in the commercial real estate value chain who were systematically rewarded for inefficiency and penalized for efficiency. If you were trying to devise a set of rewards and relationships and habits that would make buildings use an order of magnitude more energy than they should, cost more to build than they should, and be less pleasant, healthful, and productive to be in than they should be, you would be hard-pressed to improve on the system we've got. What can you do about all this? Well, first of all, of course, we can remind senior executives to think of saved energy costs as going to the bottom line. Think in terms like earnings per share, and not to behave as if they're capital ration. If you're not making these extraordinarily low-risk, high-return investments, you're cheating your shareholders. It's that simple. And it's important that operating and financial staff talk the same language, more on that in a minute, and talk to each other. I enjoy putting the controller and the operating engineers at the same table. Hold on a sec on that. And actually, if you really don't have the capital, you can use mechanisms like Art Rosenfeld and my alumnus of RMI, Greg Katz, invented, the International Performance Monitoring and Verification Protocol. You can Google IPMVP. And that is a way to describe very simply on a standardized form, measure, aggregate, and securitize streams of energy and water savings and finance them. You sell off the savings in advance. The money you get from selling the savings stream you use to execute the savings. City of Chicago, for example, did $0.9 billion of such financing to retrofit its schools for efficiency, and they had money left over up front to hire teachers and buy books. You could also do wraparound mortgages and other kind of add-ons to existing financing to get cheap money, but IPMVP is particularly versatile and in use in much of the world for getting very low transaction cost and low-cost capital into efficiency investments, new and retrofit. There are marketing initiatives to cut first cost. Southern Cal Edison gave away over 1 million compact fluorescent lamps because it was cheaper than running their existing power plants. Then they started leveraging markups from manufacturing through distribution all the way to retail and giving rebates to the manufacturer rather than at the retail point of sale in order to get several times as big a price reduction. Some utilities have been experimenting with leasing compact fluorescent lamps, so much per lamp per month, cheaper than power plants. And Walmart is working with GE to reduce dramatically the cost and increase the volume of compact fluorescents. They actually doubled the sales just in the first week in which they put the lamps at eye level instead of floor level. Where necessary, you may need standards to correct inherently split incentives, as in many appliances. I'm pleased to announce that 3 days ago, the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy and the National Electrical Manufacturers Association agreed to go arm in arm to Congress to raise further the motor efficiency standards to knock out everything below what is now considered premium efficiency, although within that category, there's still plenty of room for smart purchases. And of course, we need to engage the financial sector much more and figure out why it is that none of the big energy service companies has really gone to scale. They hit a wall at $1 or $2 billion volume. How can we tune up their business models and really get a lot more capital allocated to efficiency? There's $71 billion of investment last year in the clean energy space worldwide, of which 15 or so billion went to biofuels, the rest to electricity. Only a tiny bit of that, less than $10 billion, went to efficiency, most to supply. It should be the other way around because efficiency is much cheaper than supply. Some financiers are starting to understand how much money there is to be made in megawatts and megabarrels. And on the theme of getting the controller together with the operating engineers, Gil Masters' book contains a wonderful Rosetta Stone for translating between simple payback and internal rate of return. So if you put that graph on the table in between those folks, they will start to say, well, wait a minute, your hurdle rate is such and such. So that means I could do a 7-year payback and still meet your hurdle rate. Why'd you want me to do a 1-year payback? Can I do 7? Okay, cool. And then the engineers do really neat things. Of course, most of what I've described the last few days will pay back in 1 or 2 years anyway, generally less than 3. You shouldn't need to go to 7, but it's nice to know you can. Organizational failures are another big category. Why should you make waves in the bureaucracy? Why should you do something different? We're on a schedule. We can't afford to do anything different. We have to copy the last set of drawings, infectious hepatitis, serial mediocrity. A lot of stuff doesn't get measured, so it doesn't get improved. Departments of a company can't or won't cooperate with each other. This department could buy more efficient office equipment for the new building. That department would save a bundle on the size of the cooling system. Do they ever get together? Hardly. If you cut your energy costs, they just reduce your budget next year. What's the incentive? We laid off the energy managers a long time ago when we downsized. And anyway, as Steve DeCanio points out, firms satisfice, they don't optimize. You know, the Dilbert world is for real. A lot of us work in those organizations. When I go to big process industry plants, I often find some specific forms of these pathologies. Many of them were designed in an era where it's as if fuel were free, especially in things like refineries, where you have a whole bunch of fuel flowing through. And generally, they'd take care with heat, steam, and molecules, but not much care with the pumps and other electric auxiliaries. Those were delegated to junior engineers and then marked up in size a bit by several layers. And there was no shadow pricing. Somebody else would pay for the utilities. I don't get charged for what I use in my department. It's free. Now, of course, if you don't have accurate measurement with well-calibrated, properly precise sensors and you don't graphically display it to the operator, how can you know what you're doing, let alone keep improving and sharing your best practice? Big companies typically have, especially in dangerous areas like refineries, a huge bookshelf, which is the corporate design engineering practice manual, and they typically don't have the guts to blow it up and start over, which is what you basically have to do because it's so cross-referenced and interlocked, you can't just improve part of it. But we're at the stage where we really need to do that. And the operators are way too busy running the plant and running it safely to think about much else. Efficiency may be a responsibility, but it's about number 14 on the list. People are stretched thin. They don't really have bandwidth. Capital rationing is common. I had a flaming row with the head of a very large company a while back who said, I'm not going to invest in that 40-something percent saving with a 3-year payback in my big plant that you guys just identified because it's like putting flowers on coffins. We don't invest in that sector. I said, you know, what is it about a 3-year payback that's worse than your investment and the return you're offering your shareholders in other areas? He said, it's like putting flowers on coffins. I said, stop messing around. If you're not going to make money on these assets, you should sell them. If you won't do it, give me a shared savings contract. I'll go raise the money. Your major competitor just did that, and it's worth so many cents per share on his last quarter's earnings. Anyway, that CEO is no longer around. Maybe we'll do better. But there is gross underinvestment in many companies in essentially riskless high-return efficiencies. And a part of that is that we often treat physical plant people and maintenance staff as a cost center to be minimized rather than as a profit center to be optimized. Those are resourceful, smart people who can be making a lot of money for us if we properly back them with resources and self-esteem and authority. There is lack of feedback from measured performance back to the next design. We just copy the design. I was actually in a chip fab where there was a pipe running through the air, and it made a right-angle jog around an invisible obstacle and then continued. I said, what's that about? And I was told, well, we were told to copy the piping diagram exactly from the last plant, and there used to be a structural pillar in that location. I never found out where the pillar went. But, you know, inside the clean room of a chip fab, they do total quality management and continuous improvement. Outside the clean room, it's a whole other world of the utilities, the chilled water, the clean air that makes the process run, and those tribes hardly talk to each other, and outside the clean room, the rule is copy exactly. Why should you copy a pipe run exactly? Anyway, and we end up with extreme risk aversion built into the structure, built into the whole structure of rewards of that culture, so the engineers end up without much appetite for intelligent risk-taking, so they don't learn very fast, even though they're perfectly capable of it. What can we do about this? First of all, leadership. Not the same thing as management. As Grace Hopper said, lead people, or she said, manage things, lead people. Competition. That's how we do most of our outreach at RMI. We help early adopters be so conspicuously successful that their rivals are forced by competitive pressure to follow suit or lose share. It works just fine, and it's lots of fun. Compelling case studies, especially those with lower capital costs, and make them the kind of thing that the CEO can remember and relate on the golf course. Express the cost of inaction as foregone profits. You are costing this company $22,000 a day by not signing that memo. Sell another attribute they do care about. More on that later in marketing. Sometimes theatrics. Anita Burke was a very tough manager that turned the worst performing refinery into the best performing. It was actually in California over about 5 years. And at one point in another business, she needed some money to do an intelligent thing that would have saved the company a great deal of money, and her manager wouldn't give her the money. So she took out a $10 bill and a cigarette lighter and lit the money on fire. He said, "What are you doing? Put that out." She said, "Well, you're burning up $10,000 a day by not making this decision. I thought you wouldn't mind a little more going up in smoke." She got her money. Sometimes I advise people to sneak in over the weekend and retrofit the CEO's office and then write a little memo after nothing's been noticed for a few weeks about, "Well, you may have noticed a little better quality of light, and the lights go off after you've left the room, and here's how much energy we're saving in there by doing these things that actually make it better and more productive for you. And if we did that all over the company, here's what it would do on earnings per share." That often helps. State of Washington has a pretty neat thing. If anybody in the government does something smart to save money, they get some of it. Their kind of work group or team or organization gets some of it to invest in more such savings without having to go back to capital budget. So they get a little kitty they can use on the side for what they think needs doing. And then most of it goes back to the general fund, so the legislature knows it's a good idea. So you pay off everybody you need to spread the joy around. You can incentivize people. There was a utility that started paying its marketing staff for measured savings, independently monitored by a third party. The savings got tenfold bigger and cheaper pretty fast. You can add energy performance to personnel performance reviews. What a concept. Reward what you want. And of course, your workers are a distributed resource in the community. Ben and Jerry started giving advice and finance for home weatherization as a fringe benefit, tax-free. Really good. Keeps on giving. Texas Instruments actually did that more efficient chip fab that I mentioned last night, largely because Paul Westbrook, one of their lead engineers, had made his house three times more efficient. He had some of his vice presidents over to see it, and as he was showing him around, one of them, as hoped, asked, "Gee, this is really interesting engineering. Could we do this in our plants?" Yep, and we did. Regulatory failures, another big deal. Almost every utility in the world is rewarded for selling you more energy and penalized for cutting your bill. And the sort of restructuring that many places, including all of Europe, have done further destroys any incentive to save. Just meeting code, which is the worst you're allowed to do without going to jail, wastes money. You need to do a lot better than code if you want to save money. The British phrase for not doing better is CATNAP, which stands for cheapest available technology, narrowly avoiding prosecution. The transport sector is the most sort of Stalinist, centrally planned sector in many countries and the most underpriced. There are a few places like Singapore that actually charge more or less the social cost of driving and have very little congestion. Compare that to Bangkok, where a sixth of the nation's GDP vanishes into traffic jams in Bangkok. Obsolete rules. I remember in Hong Kong a long time ago, they adopted the Singapore rules for what's called overall thermal transfer value. Well, these rules were devised before Lawrence Berkeley Lab and others had developed spectrally selective windows that could let in light without heat. And Singapore, in its usual fashion, said, "Well, everybody will now adopt the OTTV standard and you will retrofit your buildings. The cost is your problem." So people put up a lot of dark heat-absorbing glass to try to meet the standard because it was a way of blocking heat, sort of, except that the dark windows also block the light. So then you need more electric light inside, which ended up as heat, and half the heat that was absorbed in the window glass radiated back inside. So you're sort of back where you started. So I found Hong Kong about to adopt this same silly standard. There's no evidence it saves energy. It may well use more, but they didn't measure. And I think I convinced the Hong Kong ministers responsible not to do this silly thing they were about to do, except as soon as I was out of town, the civil servants got back to them and said, "Well, we've spent a lot of time developing the new regulations, and let's just do it now and we'll fix it later." Two renewals of the regulations later, it's still there. dispersed land use mandated by old zoning that mandates segregation by use, by income, and so on. What can we do about these things? Well, utility regulatory reform, NRDC in the lead. The regulatory assistance product, RapOnline.com, advises commissions how to do it. More about that in a minute. Real estate developers in some jurisdictions, I think Santa Barbara County was one of the first, said anybody coming in with an efficient green project can go to the head of the queue for approvals. That costs the government nothing, but to a developer, time is money. We're discovering through new urbanism that more thoughtful land use design actually yields very much greater real estate value. David Goldstein, NRDC, and others have pioneered locationally efficient mortgages with the likes of Fannie Mae. Parking cash outs are a very valuable way to put money in the competition between driving to work and other modes of getting to work or not needing to. You could offer developers, instead of buying an expensive parking space, they could annuitize a perpetual transit pass for the unit. That will cost them 10 or 20 times less, so they kind of like that idea. Some home builders are starting to market projects by selling with zero utility bills the first 5 years you own it. Or if it's over, well, one of them said $50 a year, I'll pay the difference. Nobody believed him, so he raised his guarantee to $100 a year, pocketed the 50, and soon had a 60% market share in his three-county area and a waiting list from hundreds of miles away. So that kind of marketing can distinguish you in a crowded market. We need better information for specifiers. The Copper Development Association has done a socially efficient wire-sized table to replace the National Electrical Code table. Naturally, it sells more copper, but it also saves money. Zoning. How about publicizing the costs of the kind of nutty land use we have, and charging congestion fees and optimizing street parking prices? In a number of cities, it's turning out maybe 30% of all the traffic congestion is caused by people cruising around looking for curb parking because it's so much cheaper than garage parking. Nice piece about this in the New York Times today by Dr. Shoup. I think we're going to see a new coalition between the immobilized class, those who are too young, poor, or infirm to drive, that's maybe a third or a half of us, and anti-tax conservatives who don't like paying developers' costs imposed on them because the developers didn't pay their own costs. Informational failures. Do you happen to know exactly where to get all this neat, efficient stuff? How many of you know what your electricity rate is per kilowatt hour on average? Okay, the rest of you know who you are. How many know how many kilowatt hours a year your refrigerator uses? Fewer of you. How many know where to get a refrigerator 2 times more efficient than the one you've got? Good. How about 10 or 20 times more efficient than the one you've got? Boy, there must be some really good researchers here. The rest of you go to aceee.org to get at least the 2 times one. That's your energy efficient appliance guide. I mean, in this country, we use 10 or 20 giant power plants running full-time just to run stuff in various sectors that is turned off, when we can get all the same convenience with no more than one of those plants, same capital cost. Information tends to stick to people who have it but don't need it. A lot of information is missing altogether, and there is misinformation. Even in fine media, there is deliberate disinformation. For example, during the California power crisis, a lot of people said, well, this is because California hasn't built any power plants in the 90s. California actually built 6,000 or 7,000 megawatts of power plants in the 90s, but they were distributed and not utility-owned. So they didn't show up in the database of utility-owned central plants. You had to look elsewhere. There are some folks called Peter Huber and Mark Mills, who put out for the Western Fuels Association an amazing report saying that your Palm Pilot and all the back-of-the-curtain servers and stuff connected to it uses as much electricity as your refrigerator, off by a factor of at least hundreds, if not thousands. John Coomey is, what? 2,000. Thank you, John. John nailed that one. And they said that 8% of all the electricity in the United States around, what, 1999? 2,000, thank you. This is in a mendacious article in Forbes magazine. 8% of all the electricity, they said, is running The internet, the servers, and 13% running all office equipment, and they said that would grow to 50% in 10 years and eat the grid, so we needed to build lots more power plants burning coal. And that's what persuaded the White House to get off Kyoto. It was all a lie. They should know it's a lie. It was absolutely nailed in peer-reviewed literature. It's been ripped to shreds by a number of us, John Coomey most of all. And yet Forbes never published a retraction. The authors keep making the same claims. They cost investors billions of dollars. What can we do about these things? Well, labeling is one good way to overcome information gaps. It can be official. It can be voluntary. There was a voluntary house labeling scheme not far from here. And pretty soon you couldn't sell or rent a house without the voluntary label because people figured if it didn't have a label, there must be something wrong with it. If people don't want to label stuff, you can stick on your own. Easily available customer information helps a lot. How about making bills transparent so you can get some idea of where your energy's going? Smart meters can help with that. Voluntary standards can lead the market, like the leadership in energy and environmental design of the U.S. Green Building Council. You can make transparency competitive. I recently persuaded a very large maker of computer power supplies, which are a big culprit in energy wasting data equipment, to put on the nameplate of every power supply a curve of the efficiency of that power supply as a function of load, and that would implicitly challenge their competitors to do the same. Pretty soon your utility will be able to send you a note saying, we have been doing some diagnostics on your bill and it appears that there's a slipping belt in your fan and your refrigerator has run out of refrigerant. Would you like us to come fix it for you? With signature recognition, they could do that. They should be careful about privacy, but there are ways to do that. And in companies, we often recommend a lending library of measuring tools, rewarding a curiosity culture, giving a prize every week or every month for the person who discovers the most recent, the most interesting measurement you learn the most from. And of course, when people lie about stuff, we should hold them to account. Value chain risks. Why should manufacturers take the risk of new products without knowing they'll sell? But if you don't make it, how can you buy it? And when your water heater breaks and you want the most efficient one, but that isn't what they got, and you'll be out of hot water for a week if you wait for it, what do you do? And then there are litigation risks that lead to defensive behavior and inhibit innovation. So the golden carrot helps relieve the market entry risk by pre-identifying and aggregating that latent demand. Platinum carrot helps even more. EPA had a system that the first communities to adopt innovative wastewater treatment systems, if it didn't work, EPA would pay for replacing it with a conventional one, so they weren't taking the technological risk, and that speeded innovation. BC Hydro wanted to shift to premium efficiency motors. They had a lot of big mills and mines with enormous motors using lots of electricity and efficiently, and they told the distributors, well, you know, when that mill wants a replacement motor is when a motor just died and they want the next one you can get on the loading dock in the next 2 hours, so you better have it in stock. Tell you what, we'll pay the carrying charge for premium efficiency motors that you stock, but not for others. And just that little bit of help took the market share of premium motors from 3% to 60% in 3 years. Very good market transformation. PG&E found that they could get 3 times the saving on refrigerators at much lower cost by giving, I think it was a $50 cash bonus to the shop assistant who sells you the efficient fridge, but nothing for selling you an inefficient one. The inefficient ones get sent to Nevada. You get the idea. And of course, breakthrough design can eliminate big zones of potential litigation if you change corporate culture appropriately. Perverse incentives. The split incentives are one of the biggies. One person chooses the technology that will use the energy, another pays the bills. Landlord-tenant, builder-buyer, maker and user of industrial equipment. More on that in a minute. We pay our design professionals for what they spend, not what they save. And there are the perverse incentives all the way through the value chain. And then another big one we often forget is that wasteful old equipment is often resold into the secondary market, not scrapped, when it should be scrapped. So to address those, on landlord and tenant, In say, a commercial triple net lease, you can often, without reopening the lease negotiation, put on a lease rider in a standard form that will equitably share costs and benefits. And even in residential leases, you can come up with a thing like that. There's a benefit to be had for both parties. Just figure out how to share it. And you can use standards, fee-bates for buildings, utility incentives for beating standards, service leasing, like most space heating in the French commercial sector is from service providers called chauffagistes. How they keep your premises comfortable is their business. You just pay them for the comfort service. Developers can market with low or no utility bills, as I mentioned. For designers, we can solve the problem with performance-based fees, and there's a protocol on our website from Charles Ely and Associates about that, now part of Architectural Energy. In the real estate value chain, that's a much more complicated discussion because there are about 24 parties, but with unrelenting attention, you can systematically exploit those business opportunities. It takes a lot of education of key parties like appraisers and leasing brokers. But if you publicize the market success of early adopters, competitors catch on pretty fast. You can do scrappage incentives. We do that for some appliances. Some utilities will actually pay you to take away your old refrigerator, and they will vampire out the halocarbons that would otherwise cause global warming or ozone damage. Unocal paid people to scrap clunker cars to offset its refinery emissions. But we can do much wider scrappage incentives. The copper industry, for example, might find it interesting to pay to scrap inefficient motors. Utilities could go in on that too. And we could build trade-in deals and reverse logistics into the new market channels for practically everything where it's worth scrapping old stuff. And in global trade, we ought to be identifying, tracking, labeling, and stigmatizing the trade in inefficient energy-using devices, bad motors and ballasts, because the way they suck up enormous amounts of capital in the power sector causes underfunding of things like clean water, infant immunization, female literacy. It probably causes about as much human misery as the drug trade, and we ought to stamp it out. Now, efficiency is a rapidly moving target. The size and the electricity use of American refrigerators was going up steeply until California introduced standards, eventually followed by federal standards. And here's the latest federal standard. And you can see they've gotten about three times more efficient, even though the refrigerators got bigger. They actually stopped getting bigger after a while because they wouldn't fit in the kitchen anymore if they did. Well, the standard Japanese market model in 1995 was here. The best one 10 years later was here, a good deal better than our standard. I know it's not the same test procedure, but it's still interesting how much steeper their slope was than ours. On the other hand, there's a ways to go. I've had this one in my house since 1985, made by Sunfrost. This is the state of the art. And by the way, refrigerators got cheaper during all this. We're not talking about paying more. False or absent price signals are another category of market failures. Over $230 billion a year subsidies to fossil fuels worldwide, according to the World Bank. Some think that's a gross underestimate. A lot of unpriced externalities, not just environmental, but many other kinds. And dilution by other costs. You know, if you pay a high gasoline tax, as we do now to OPEC, gasoline is still cheaper than bottled water in this country. It's only a sixth the total cost of driving when it's at $2.40 a gallon. So it's diluted 5-to-1 by all the other costs of owning and running a car, and then you discount it very heavily. Of course, it's a weak signal to buy an efficient car. It's only a strong signal to drive less if you have an alternative. Very few companies track energy costs properly to profit centers. Your aggregated bill in your house is not itemized. It doesn't say this much for the fridge, this much for the water heater. So how do you know where it's going and how to save to reduce your bill? Many appraisers don't count the value of efficiency. They claim the market doesn't. And companies have to expense fuel but capitalize investments in energy efficiency. It's not a level playing field. When the Japanese wanted to put scrubbers on their power plants, they just said you can expense them in year one. And they got most of them put in very, very quickly. What can we do about these? Well, we can smoke out subsidizers and subsidizees and attach some shame to being a professed free marketeer while you pocket lots of taxpayer money. Subsidies should be tracked annually. The economics community should be engaged. Maybe we should offset federal subsidies with state tax regimes and make California a subsidy-free zone for energy. What an idea. Maybe we should do similarly for externalities. We can do labeling as well. In fact, the great engineer Paul McCready says we should put on every gasoline pump a sign that says burning each gallon of gasoline puts more than 19 pounds of CO2 into the air, where it will remain for 100 years, and buying each gallon provides over 40 cents to countries that hate the United States. Light vehicle rebates are a great solution. Rewards for scrapping old inefficient vehicles are too. In companies, we need activity-based costing, sub-metering, lots of data loggers so people can measure stuff. Informative bills. You may actually be able soon at big stores to get a bill at the checkout that says what the carbon content is, directly and indirectly, of each item you've bought. There are third-party information providers springing up to do that. Appraisers should use a cash flow method, and informed and assertive buyers and leasing brokers can get that value expressed. Energy rating systems are great, and you can introduce expensing of energy savings investment to level the playing field so that whether you spend a dollar to buy fuel or save fuel, it has the same tax treatment. I think we could make a good argument to Treasury. This is such a strong business stimulus and will so boost American competitiveness that it may well increase net revenue to Treasury if you model it properly. Finally, there are incomplete markets and property rights. No market in saved energy. You can't bounty hunt for wasted energy. You can't trade megawatt futures and options. You usually can't bid them against megawatts. And there are few tradable property rights in saved depletion, saved resources, saved pollution, or in reduced uncertainty of energy demand. So those things can't really express their value in the market. We do have standard measurement protocols like IPMVP for savings in buildings, not very good ones yet for most industries. Some solutions. Morro Bay made water savings fungible. They said to the builders, if you want to build a house here, you must first save twice as much water somewhere else in town. They got 2/5 of the houses retrofitted in the first 4 years. And imagine how this can work. A guy comes to your door and says, ma'am, here's this gorgeous toilet designed by a Swedish sculptor. There's one in the Museum of Modern Art in New York. I want to give it to you and install it for free. And you say, yeah, I heard you guys are doing that. What's it worth to you? How much do you want to pay me to let you put this thing in my house? How much do you want your building permit? When you make a bargain in saved water, you discover what it's worth. Goleta did really well in savings with 1 year with no loss of service quality. If you, again, making the savings fungible mean that I can bounty hunt, I can save energy over here and sell it to somebody over there. New York City saved billions of dollars by protecting its watershed instead of expanding its potable water treatment plant. New England has just started to let megawatts bid into the regional electricity supply auctions. And you don't need to wait for the regulators. You can do side deals, side contracts bilaterally in stuff that isn't in the tariffs, and utilities can reward bounty hunters with or without regulatory approval, I think. So each of these things offers a major business opportunity. Those opportunities have been grasped in a few exemplary cases. If you pay attention, you'll find a lot more places to do it, and competition will help you spread the word. This has been speeding up lately, and there is a lot of attention now starting to be paid in the financial community, as in that April meeting that Dan Ryker will run in New York. So the traditional policy slate that all we can do is prices and taxes and regulation or deregulation is really cramped and impoverished. We can do a whole lot more than that in policy that will probably work better. The secret sauce, of course, on the shop floor level is paying attention. Southwire cut its electric intensity 40%, gas intensity 60% in a rather short time. That should say, I believe, 1981 to 87, just 7 years, and then even more, all with paybacks under 2 years. The two engineers who were responsible for that probably preserved 4,000 jobs at 10 plants in 6 states. And what the lead engineer said, it took only an act of management will and design mentality consistently applied, paying attention. Dow, 81 to 83, Louisiana division, ran a contest for saving energy and reducing waste. Year one, 27 projects, 173% ROI. They said, there can't be much more of that. That isn't supposed to be possible. But let's try it another year. Next year, 32 projects, 340% ROI. The worst year was the one in which they fell out of triple digits to only a 97% return. The first 12 years, almost 900 projects averaging over 200% predicted and confirmed by audit returns, $110 million a year on the bottom line, and the returns and savings were trending upwards in the later years because, as usual, the engineers were discovering new tricks faster than they used up the old ones. Success was recognized on the shop floor, not rewarded. Ken Nelson, who ran this, didn't want people to think it wasn't part of their job, and he didn't tell the senior management. He didn't want them to get in the way and start coming up with committees and memos. The key was shifting the shop floor culture to attention and curiosity. And when Ken retired, it kind of fell apart. Now, even cheap energy can be saved very quickly. We've done it before with high and rising prices and a sense of urgency. Now we can substitute high and rising skill and attention. And there are a lot of hooks to focus attention. Current or future price signals, which may be enhanced by trading, by insurer pressure. All kinds of leadership, political, business, social, spiritual, at any level. Concern by the public, by customers, about security, climate, creation, care, whatever your issue is. Similar personal concerns of investors, employees, executives, competitive pressure, competitiveness in general, jobs, community renewal, local issues. And private sector leadership can focus attention and shift fashions pretty quickly to transform big systems. The way we do this in a capitalist society is by marketing. Why does efficient end use get so little attention and respect? Well, it's scattered in zillions of invisible little pieces that all look the same whether they're efficient or not. It doesn't really get on the TV cameras. It doesn't attract the politicians or the rent seekers much because it's in little pieces. Home buyers often think efficiency is binary, like having a garage. Do you have one or not? Economists often presume if more efficiency were worthwhile, we would have done it already, so it must eat higher prices to work. Many policymakers think, oh, efficiency, yeah, we did that in the 70s, as if they couldn't start all over again, even if they just did it last year. And often they'll disdain big savings as saying, well, that can't be possible, see economists. Designers often aren't told or rewarded to diverge from their past design practice, and most textbooks get the teaching wrong, and many specialists can't even keep up with the pace of progress. Executives are typically focused on bigger factor costs, typically labor. Installers tend to come when something's broken and you call them, not ahead of time, to make you a deal. And the media tend to forget what they learned, and marketers haven't yet seriously enrolled. Those are all opportunities. Energy anthropology teaches us that there's a lot to be done. If you look at how much of the time an air conditioner runs in an unoccupied apartment versus how hot it is, you get a straight line validating the engineering theory of thermostats. If you put people in the apartment now and you tell them that the air conditioning and the electricity, well, the electricity and the machine are free, what do you think they do? Well, an economist would probably say they'll turn on the air conditioner when they feel hot and they'll set the thermostat at a temperature which they feel comfortable. Nope. 25 to 35% do that, but there's no correlation here. It's not driven by comfort. It's driven by, it turns out, the energy anthropologist discovered, folk theories about how air conditioners work, general theories for dealing with machines, belief systems about health and physiology, household schedules, noise aversion, and conversely, liking white noise that might mask outside sounds that might wake the baby. People are complicated. Marketers know this. Marketers are very good at dealing with human complexity. So if you're a utility load dispatcher, you might say, well, how people use air conditioners, that just depends on income and how hot it is outside, and a hot day is something that makes the needles go to the right. It's the load from hell. And then if you're a comfort theorist, you say, well, actually, there are six variables, and if the Fanger comfort equation is satisfied, then these ambulatory 70-kilogram adult white male watery sacks out there will say that they're comfortable and they'll have a certain index of skin wettedness and mean percent dissatisfied and the other metrics we use. Now, if you're an econometrician, you'd say, well, actually, there are people out there, but instead of being disembodied, instead of having bodies and no brains, they have brains and no bodies. They're disembodied cost-benefit calculating machines. They have price and income elasticities, utility functions, hedonic indices, discount rates. If you're an energy anthropologist, however, You know that there are people out there, they have bodies and brains and maybe souls, and they're bundles of needs, wishes, hopes, fears, beliefs, myths, all conditioned by history and culture. Well, the energy anthropologist model of how people use air conditioning is not complete, but it actually is more accurate and more helpful than the other three put together. So we actually tell our utility clients in all seriousness, if you want to understand how your customers use air conditioning, don't hire an econometrician or a comfort engineer, hire a cultural anthropologist or a sociologist. And it's similar for a lot of other end uses. We don't really know much yet about what goes on in people's heads when they use energy, but we know it's complicated and we need to rethink policy and marketing according to what the social science teaches us about energy using behavior. But one thing we do know for sure is you can market energy efficiency without mentioning energy efficiency. Customer wants interest in her business, not yours. You have to speak to her concerns in her language. Talk to folks where they're at, not where you're at. And you can sell energy efficiency as a profitable way to achieve what the customer wants, which may have nothing to do with energy. Because the side benefits are worth one, two, even three orders of magnitude more money to the customer than the energy savings. Those benefits are big, they're ubiquitous. No matter what sector you're in, there are big side benefits. Let me show you some numbers. In an office, productivity gains are 164 times or so more valuable than energy savings, because that's the ratio of salaries, benefits, and technology costs of a worker per square foot per year to energy costs per square foot per year. So if you increase labor productivity a little over 0.5%, you have the same bottom line effect as eliminating the energy bill. We actually see productivity gains not of 0.5%, but of 6 to 16%. Lockheed 157, not a four-year payback on the daylighting, but a one-year payback because of 15% lower absenteeism and higher productivity, a very common result. And then Lockheed, because of lower overheads, won a tough contract whose profits paid for the whole building. Lockheed clammed up at that point. And their CEO said, we said way too much about this building. It's a big source of competitive advantage. Verifone in Irvine, one-year payback, not 7.5, because of higher productivity. The lights are off in this assembly plant. Walmart accidentally discovered something that's now more generally known, 40% higher retail sales pressure in well-daylit stores. Stop and Shop, when the CEO saw this gorgeously daylit store and saw how much extra it cost, he said, we'll never do that again. Then he saw the per card sales figure and said, we're going to do that on every store. You can imagine in a grismal climate like Britain how nice that is to shop in. Boeing's main assembly plant, lighting retrofits, up to 90% savings, less than two-year payback, but the workers could see better. Less rework, fewer defects, more on-time delivery, happier customers, worth much more. And yet lighting design is hardly part of our industrial vocabulary. It's rare for workers to see what they're doing. Lawrence Berkeley reviewed 52 industrial case studies in six rich countries and found that if you explicitly value the gains in industrial productivity, you cut the average efficiency payback times in half. And in 63% of savings, the non-energy benefits were worth more than the energy benefits. And then they found in the iron and steel industry, if you counted non-energy benefits from 47 kinds of energy-saving retrofits, you could afford to save twice as much energy. Big deal. Now, marketers know a lot of ways to make efficiency cool and sexy, like the ads in the X Games with those famous hot dog snowboarders saying, keep winter cool, it's short enough already. That was a climate protection ad. And cars are vehicles for emotions. Try this. This is for an experimental battery electric performance car that has a third the energy intensity of a Prius. And they're putting it up against a Ferrari.
And $150,000 for the X1.
And in the next frame, it smokes a Porsche. I won't trouble you with that. But you think you could sell that when cars are a vehicle for emotion? Electricity. We know the efficiency works. California's held per capita use flat for 30 years while it went up in the rest of the country, and it went up starting from a lower base in Western Europe. Half the savings from standards, half from rewarding utilities for cutting your bill, not selling more energy. Same deal in New England. And the biggest lever to pull is to reward megawatt providers for cutting your bill. It's the most important thing we can do in electricity, and with carbon rebates, it's one of the top two things we can do for CO2. It got derailed by restructuring when we were starting to adopt it. It's now coming back, NRDC in the lead. And actually, I won't go into it here. We can later if you want, but you combine a balancing account to decouple revenues from sales volumes with letting the utility share a little of the savings achieved for the customers. That's a real carrot. It's not a stick painted orange. And it wonderfully changes the culture. PG&E in 92 invested over $170 million to help customers save energy cheaper than it could be produced. This generated almost $400 million in present valued benefits. Customers got 89% of that benefit as lower bills. Shareholders got 11% as higher dividends, the second biggest source of profit for the utility that year. Over $40 million straight to the bottom line with no risk and no cost to the utility. And if you are running the efficiency department and you produce that result, I'll bet your CEO calls you up every week and says, is there anything you need? And all the smartest people in the company will want to work in the efficiency department to advance their career. So decoupling and shared savings are an enormous deal. We have electric decoupling now in California and Idaho, more on the way. We have gas decoupling in 8 states, more on the way. It's a really big thing to do. There's a lot more that we can do at a state level. In fact, we can even buy out inefficient stuff like electric water heaters and electric stoves. We can do rebates for buildings, expedited approvals, get rid of barriers in the building codes and code practice, and integrate climate into land use and other regulation. Community mass retrofits are also valuable. The Hood River County project in Oregon to test the upper bounds of full rapid installation of super insulation in almost 1,500 houses, old stick-built leaky houses, got stuff into 85% of the eligible homes in 2 years, and over 60% of people signed up before the ads started. Huge demand for it. The people who did that great marketing and installation are still around. 83% of the recommended measures were installed. Savings were 5% above forecast. Now, in business strategy, in electricity, efficiency's cheap, electricity's expensive. The gap's widening. Customers figure this out. They want to buy less electricity and more efficiency. The only question is who's going to sell them the efficiency. It's smart to sell customers what they want before someone else does. And, you know, whether you formally sell megawatts or not, customers can buy them from you or from somebody else. And every customer hassle in buying megawatts is a business opportunity for utilities and other providers. Of course, if you build the utility inside out, instead of just building generation and power lines, you can start with the customer and ask, what's causing the growth in demand in the areas where we're about to invest in costly distribution? And if we target efficiency and demand response on those end uses in that neighborhood, aiming them like a rifle instead of a shotgun, it turns out that you can then reduce capital investment about tenfold, and you never need to build the transmission and generation because you solve the problem in the distribution planning area much cheaper. Efficiency can work quickly even with old methods. And in fact, in 83 to 85, 10 million people in Southern California were cutting the 10-year ahead forecast of utility peak load by 8.5% every year, at 1% the cost of new supply. Some other investments went in very, very fast. But new delivery methods are even better. They don't just market megawatts, they make markets in megawatts. So they maximize competition in who saves and how. So that's my last topic. The old methods were we'd tell people how to save, sometimes we'd help finance it. Then we discovered it was cheaper to give it away. We did demos and pilot projects and set up third-party investors and lease stuff. But these just maximize participation and savings per participant. They're very effective methods. Rebates were the backbone of most of the programs, and they became generic. You save, we pay. We don't care how you do it. Sometimes we'd pay for scrapping inefficient old stuff or beating standards or doing good design. That's very powerful. You don't need to pay for efficient equipment because it usually costs less. Pay the designers to spec the efficient equipment and integrate it properly. Well, there are a lot of other old methods, but I think it's more exciting to add to those new methods that make markets in megawatts. Competitive bidding. Central Maine Power asked which factories want to save electricity at what price will take the low bids. This turned into all-source bidding. Megawatts and megawatts bidding against each other. Fungible savings. Wheeling savings between customers, between jurisdictions. Being able to make spot and futures and options markets in saved electricity. Commitments that my building will never use more than X megawatts, so you don't need to project that it's going to, and I can sell that back to you as a planning resource. Investing in human and organizational capital, very lucrative. Bootstrapping operational savings in the utility itself. Load management cooperatives to conveniently share the dispatch of saved peak load. Letting electricity and gas companies sell each other's kinds of efficiency and get rewarded for both. Market transformation, like my BC Hydro Big Motors example. Fee-based for new buildings. That drives continuous improvement, and it's not obsolete before the ink is dry. Systematic barrier busting. Targeted mass retrofits. Swapping customers. Gas and electric utilities each have customers they'd rather not have. They can give to the other one. It works better for them. New partners. Multi-resource consortia. New kinds of marketing partners. Selling advanced retrofits potential to turn around distressed commercial properties. You can sell that to financial institutions with non-performing assets. Piggyback on retrofits being done anyway for, say, chlorofluorocarbons or air conditioner replacements. So that's the gift in the arms of the problem. Suppose your air conditioner dies. You go to the dealer for a new one. The dealer offers you a better deal. They'll fix up your house so it won't need an air conditioner, or maybe it'll need a very much smaller one. And the dealer can make more money selling you that service than just selling you a new air conditioner. You get better comfort cheaper. You don't care how you do it. Suppose you run a factory and the utility imposes a power factor charge it should have imposed a long time ago and start charging penalties for people with bad power factor. So you gripe because you're going to have to put in these expensive capacitors. Anybody whose bill is going to go up, how about the utility comes to them and says, we'll retrofit your motor systems, as I described Tuesday night, right-sized premium efficiency motors. That correct power factor is a free byproduct of the free energy savings. So your bill will go down because you're using less electricity. The utility will save a lot of money too. Everybody wins. Isn't that a better deal? We just need to coordinate to get the pieces together. And that means not just relying on politics as usual or gridlock as usual. Thucydides, 400-odd BC, reported that the Peloponnesians and their allies were mighty in battle, but handicapped by their policy-making bottle, in which he related each presses its own end, which generally results in no action at all. They devote more time to the prosecution of their own purposes than to consideration of the general welfare. Each supposes that no harm will come of his own neglect, that it's the business of another to do this and that. And so, as each separately entertains the same illusion, the common cause imperceptibly decays. Are we there yet? So I have a modest proposal, but as Marv Goldberger said, a spherically sensible one. It makes sense no matter which way around you look at it. How about we let all ways to save or produce energy compete fairly at honest prices, no matter which kind they are, or what technology they use, or where they are, or how big they are, or who owns them. And let's see who's not in favor of that. Churchill said you can always count on the Americans to do the right thing. After they've exhausted all other alternatives, we are working our way well down the list, but I think we're getting there. Thank you for your kind attention.
Amory, I think it's a while since someone displayed a slide in this auditorium in the original Greek. I think I'll begin with several in the audience are concerned that your implementation strategies are dominated by technology fixes and that you are not sufficiently emphasizing attitude and behavioral change. Do you plead guilty as charged?
No. I did the technology the last three nights. What I talked about tonight is implementation. What may be unfamiliar is that I wasn't saying simply the government must tell you what to do or we must have this change in public policy to help you do it. I had a lot of that in there, please note. But I also had some breakthroughs in competitive strategy. That's another kind of innovation. It's not technological, and I talked a lot about that last night in the transportation context. Changes in design and developer and so on attitudes. So I guess maybe I'd agree to that extent. And changes in the behavior of mindful markets. So, you know, maybe guilty as charged, but maybe not in the sense in which the questioner meant it.
But you are not outlining an agenda of sacrifice for the American public.
No.
Amory, you in various ways have described strategies for getting better comfort at lower cost. Some worry that one result of that will be that people will simply demand more comfort and that you will get what is called a bounce back effect that wipes out a lot of your efficiency and savings gains. What do you have to say about that?
Well, if you are already warm, you do not simply raise the thermostat further. The rich do not roast. Which is actually what we used to call the official British model that had heating demand as simply a linear function of income without limit. What will happen is that very poor people who couldn't heat their house will start heating a room or two rooms or whatever, and they will be better off. They'll have a better quality of life. Economists normally call that a benefit, not a cost. And they will use some more energy, but actually more to heat themselves, less to heat outer space, which is not the right kind of space heating. Now, the whole bounce back effect is a standard fallacy that some economist rediscovers about every 10 years. It is theoretically correct that if energy services get cheaper because of more productive use of energy, you may buy more of them, and that if you get money back by saving energy costs, you will respend it, and what you spend it on uses some energy. But let me add a few important qualifiers. There are saturations. If your clothes are already clean and you have a more efficient washing machine, you will not rewash your clothes. If your food is already properly cold in the refrigerator and you get a more efficient refrigerator, you will not turn down the thermostat because the milk would freeze, and so on. It is also as if, I think, Ralph, you may have used this simile, as if you were in a grocery store, and when you came to the checkout counter, they just handed you a bill with no itemization. So you don't know how much was for rice and how much was for lobster, and you don't know which item was on sale. You simply don't have the itemized information to do what the rebound theorists normally say. But a lot depends on how educated you are about what you just did. If you saved energy and your costs went down, you could use the saved money to go helicopter skiing, or you could use it to buy more weather stripping and insulation and a bicycle. And maybe you'll take the money saved from that and plant a veggie garden or put up a passive solar retrofit on your house. So you can actually bootstrap more and more energy savings. And one last thing, yes, rebound effects exist. They are found in the econometric literature. They are typically very small. They're in the few percent range. In pathological cases, they might get to a few tens of percent. In the case of driving, I think they're about 1.5% net. But there is nothing you can buy with the saved energy that has more energy content per dollar than the energy you saved. Therefore, there will always be a net saving. It is impossible to save energy through efficiency and end up using more energy as a result, as I believe Huber has claimed. And if that were true, of course, then we should mandate inefficient energy-using equipment in order to reduce energy use.
Amory, you talked about the importance of creating more tradable property rights as a way of accelerating progress in energy efficiency. How do you feel about the emerging markets in carbon reduction? We have a representative here, I know, of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, which is involved in helping customers take advantage of opportunities to add more renewable energy to the grid. The Chicago Climate Exchange is another example cited by many. What do you think about those
developments? Yeah, in fact, we're an associate member of the Chicago Climate Exchange. I think it will be very helpful as long as we don't grandfather anybody. I think in economic theory, all emitters are on the margin. Somebody who's been running a power plant for 20 years is just as marginal an emitter as a newcomer wanting to emit carbon. And if they want to emit carbon, they should both have to pay for it at a market clearing price. Otherwise, you don't get efficient allocation or distribution.
And I think I'll close by just posing a question to Amory and to all of you, which we'll give him a chance to think about overnight. One of your questioners is interested whether the principles that you've outlined over these lectures might also be productively applied to the process of education itself, as opposed to the processes of energy use, and whether you would have some reflections on the implications of what you're saying for that very different, but to many in this audience, equally consequential social question. I think I will leave that hanging over you and ask all of you to thank Amory for his remarks this evening.
You've been listening to a lecture by Amory Lovins in our MAP Energy series. Amory Lovins was a MAP Ming Visiting Professor for Energy and the Environment at Stanford. This lecture series was sponsored by MAP as part of its commitment to fostering sustainable energy education. For more information, visit MAP online at maproyalty.com. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Chris Hartman. Our website editor was Charlie Batheau. The series producer is Sheila Setharaman.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nee on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.